Welcome to 45 North. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Imagine being 10 years old and having the fate of the world on your shoulders. Well, the fourth grade students who play their teacher John Hunter's World Peace game know exactly what that feels like. They've dealt with armed uprisings, giant oil spills, civil wars, stock market crashes, and every other global crisis imaginable. For some of these kids, it's a life-changing experience. John Hunter is the elementary school teacher who invented this game. It's been the subject of a documentary, a celebrated TED Talk, and now a book, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. John Hunter, welcome to 45 North.
Oh, thanks for having me so much. It's wonderful to be here with you.
It's just great to have you here. So if we were standing in your classroom right now, looking at a group of kids playing this game, what would we see?
Well, you'd likely call it chaos. You'd see a group of about 25 to 30 students up and dashing about, having heated, spirited conversations with each other in a frantic sort of way, and then a little tiny bell would ring, and they'd all rush back to their seats and reconvene in their cabinet positions and start really declaring their intentions.
And the game itself, as a physical object, this is kind of like a board game on steroids, right? It's like four levels of stacked plexiglass.
Yeah, that's right. It's 4 foot by 4 foot by 4 foot. It towers over most of my nine-year-olds. There are four levels of 4x4 plexiglass horizontal sheets stacked, as you say, one above the other. They emulate the Earth. There's an undersea level, a ground and sea level, an aircraft level, and even an outer space level, with hundreds or thousands even of game pieces on every level and 50 interlocking global problems that the students have to solve.
That sounds gorgeous.
And we have a great time with it, yeah.
Well, and then the kids come in, and I'm sure they all want to immediately touch the plexiglass levels and play with all that stuff. But what you do is you begin by handing them this 13-page document listing dozens of crises facing this world.
Actually, there's a $50 million fine for bumping the board accidentally. So their gross and fine motor skills really hone in over the semester. But yeah, we have a dossier of template documents and treaties and blank sheets to fill in. And then they get the 13-page crisis document with 50 interlocking global problems. They're designed so that if one problem is attempted to be solved or changed, everything else connected with it solves. Connected with it also changes. It's interdependent, and it sort of tries to emulate the interdependency of real life that way. And so after 3 hours of going over that document, you know, their brains are just shutting down, which is what we want to have happen. We want that complexity to overwhelm them at first.
Wait, why? Because I've read that you deliberately overwhelm them with complexity. These are fourth graders. Why?
Yeah, you know, we have that perception that children have such delicate, fragile minds that we really need to be so careful and break things down into pre-chewed bits and spoon-feed them. But I find that they are wise individuals. And so as a teacher, you walk a fine line between wanting them to be challenged so that it's so thrilling but so difficult they almost can't do it. So you build a curriculum around their desires, their interests, their passions, and you make it so exciting they have to do it. But you push the envelope of possibility by adding complexity rather than decreasing complexity. And they love the challenge. They rise to myriad problems with ease and with joy and with happiness to be responsible for such a huge undertaking and to be trusted by their teacher to be able to handle it.
So what are some of the crises that they deal with?
Well, we rip it from the headlines. We pretty much put everything we can get in there, appropriately modified for children. You've got ethnic, religious, and minority rights difficulties. You've got hazardous waste spills, nuclear and chemical. You've got overfishing. You've got water rights problems, aquifers being overpumped. And you've got breakaway republics, desertification, famine, endangered species, oil spills. Everything you can imagine, we've got it there. Even climate change, which the students handily have been able to solve in about a week's time.
You're kidding. Wait, how'd they do that?
Multiple times.
I know some people would like to know.
Well, you know, there are quite a few people who are interested, including the defense secretary of the Pentagon, who wanted to know how they did that. But yeah, it has been in various ways every time. I can never predict it. And I myself can't solve these problems. I designed and facilitated their activity, but they have to come to, through their collective wisdom, a new way every time. And so every game is entirely different. It's their game.
So can you tell us, I mean, I'm sure after years of playing this, you have story after story in your mind, but what's an example of, you know, a really memorable moment when there was a looming crisis and your kids did something you didn't expect? They came up with a solution you never would have dreamed of.
Right. Well, they always do. I mean, I'm never in the loop of that solution creating moment. They come up with something that's beyond my expectation. One example was our tribal group, the Nin. The Nin have a religion, as I posited in the game, that's has to be protected at all costs, no matter what. And so what they like to do is protect their ancestral remains. Well, in the game, one of the crises has it that the ancestral remains, newly discovered ones, are over their border in the territory of another country. And the Nin religious law says that they must protect and claim that land as their own part of their own homeland. Now, that's against national law or international law, so we've got a conundrum there. And the Nin prepare to go to war to reclaim that land that's theirs because their ancestors are buried there. And the other country, of course, is prepared to defend that land because technically it's theirs. So we have an impasse. And suddenly the leader of the larger country that has the remains hidden in the golden mountains of that country says to the United Nations Secretary General, "What if I became a Nin? Would that make the Nin any less, you know, mean?" And the UN didn't know what to say, so they consulted, and the weather goddess got involved, the World Bank came into it, and they finally decided that might help ease tensions, and so sure enough, this little girl decided to convert to the Nin religion, and that diffused the entire situation. Now, adults probably could never do something like this, but I marvel at the philosophical insight and the sacrifice and the critical thinking this child had to do to come up with a solution that there seemed to be no other way out. And it was a very innovative way to tackle the problem.
Wow. That's kind of
amazing. Yeah. Well, we would never do it as adults, but you know.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, we've got some actual sounds of you and the kids playing this game. This is from the film that was made, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. So if you wanted to know what the beginning of this game sounds like, here's a little sample.
Okay, Prime Ministers, here we go. We put a lot of thought and time into these selections. Would you accept the job, the office of Prime Minister? Miss Amelia Thompson, would you please stand? Yes. You accept it? Yes. Round of applause, Ms. Thompson. Mr. Cohen.
Yes.
Miss Bria Williams.
Yes. All right.
Mr. Caden Sullivan.
Yes.
Here's what we're going to do in the next steps. The Prime Minister is going to go to different corners of the room, and they're going to select their officers one by one. Now remember, you can choose your best friend all you want to. However, your best friend may not be good for that job, so choose the person in this room who can do the job for you the best. Yeah. Excellent job. Very good job.
That just makes me want to be in your classroom.
That really sometimes frustrates me.
Sorry, we got another clip in there.
Oh,
that just really
those kids.
Yeah, they
want to keep talking.
Front and center, aren't they? What was I going to ask is the prime ministers, so there are four of them because there are four countries, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you look for when you're choosing a student to be a prime minister? Are there certain temperaments?
You know, it's an intuitive decision, and I guess all teachers face that choice sometimes when choosing classroom leadership. You're looking for a student who may have that seed. It may need some watering and some fertilizing and some help with sprouting. So you're trying to get give a position to a child who can use that to grow. And every decision you make as a teacher, you try to make it based on what that child needs for their growth and development. So it's not a political decision. It has to be a very deeply personal one. And sometimes I'm wrong, but you know, the children can turn me down. I offer the position of leadership to some I have a feeling about. And they can say, "No, Mr. Hunter, I'm not ready for that. I don't want to do that." And that's quite all right. But they, in turn, get to choose their leaders, their teams, which is a huge responsibility. And they don't always choose their best friends, which is wonderful to see as well. They try to pick the best policy choices and the best diplomatic choices for those positions. So it is based on our relationship before we start who I offer those roles to.
And then there's another player you select. You name a weather goddess who does what?
Yes. Well, she's in charge of we might call it chaos or random events. You know, in life, things seem to come out of the blue sometimes. And so we want to have that aspect emulated in the game. We want the children to experience life in a safe and appropriate way. as it really comes with unpredictable moments. So the weather goddess will be pulling random cards of events. She'll handle the random weather by moving our giant puffs of cotton around on the aircraft level, making weather for different countries. And she also handles a random stock market. And those things can change radically in moments. And she also, of course, finishes with the coin toss. The coin toss, usually it's weighted in favor of the larger power, but often a smaller group can have a winning session through that. But she's in charge of that random series of events. And that really, it's like being a Supreme Court justice sometimes. We have a problem, we go to the weather goddess, and she has to rule one way or the other. Sometimes she'll call a recess and do a little research on the internet and come back to us with her decision.
And then there's one other position. This actually is my favorite. I know you know what I'm going to say. The saboteur. Yeah.
We love the saboteur. And it's not always the child who's in trouble. Sometimes it's quite a lovely child. But often that skill set of being able to be mischievous and cause difficulty is a skill set I want to use in the game. I want to ask those children to please try and, if you can, publicly achieve our two goals, which are solving all 50 interlocking problems and raising every country's asset value. That's how the game is won. Do that publicly, but privately, through misinformation, misdirection, ambiguities, creating irrelevancies, and you have a small budget, maybe a few ICBMs and a few mercenaries, try to destroy the entire game. And nobody in the room knows who that person is. We don't know who it is, but everybody knows that person's there. So we've got our critical thinking is pushed to a deeper level because every appearance may not be what it seems to be, and we're aware of that. So we've got to think more critically throughout the entire process.
Now, that position wasn't part of the game from the very beginning. Why did you create it?
No, it wasn't. Originally, in the late 70s, early 80s, I used real-world countries, and the students were doing fairly well. And suddenly, I guess about 83 or so, they hit a wall. They couldn't seem to solve problems. I didn't know why. When I discovered later what was going on, it made me change the entire game. They were simply using real-world solutions that their parents and adults tried, and they were failing. They weren't working just like ours weren't working. So I fictionalized the countries, which really opened up the creative possibilities, while keeping the template of real-world problems. And that sort of made much more creativity open up for the kids, too. And so our new situation is now that they can really try to do different things, not based on the way things have been, convention and so forth.
But why add the saboteur into the mix?
Oh, well, all right, I'll go ahead and tell you. they were winning so well, doing so well with it. I thought they needed more challenge. They needed to go to a deeper level. They needed to have more lifelike situations where things are not always as we plan them to be, not always as we want them to go. So the saboteur really forces us to be uncertain or in the unknown, as I would say, longer, and to not be completely complacent and clear about our conventional thinking. So everything is questioned. We develop a culture of questioning, a culture of inquisitiveness and inquiry throughout the entire process because we have to. So the saboteur is my greatest ally, and at the end of the game, the children always celebrate that person. They say, thank you for making this game so much harder for us. We really thank you for that.
There's a deep educational philosophy here that I want to get to. Basically, you want your kids to fail, but we're going to come back to that in just a sec. I want to hear from a couple more of your kids.
Mr. Hatcher really sometimes frustrates me when I say, can I do this? And he says, anything can happen. But he never, ever answers your question deliberately.
Why do you think he does that?
Yeah, that's it. I don't know the answer most of the time. That's why I don't answer it. And, of course, I want them to have their own moment of reflection. If I rush to answer or provide an answer for every situation, every question, their thinking is cut short. Their exploration is cut short. So when I say I don't know, two things happen. One is they're thrown back on their own resources. They have to go, well, what is it? How can I find the answer? And the other thing that arises is their compassion for me. They say, well, Mr. Hunter doesn't know. We've got to help him understand. And they really do collectively as a group want to help me because I'm not sure and I'm not certain. They want to make me a better teacher. So that compassion comes up just for me, which is so sweet to see.
John Hunter is an award-winning teacher. He's the creator of the World Peace Game, which you can see in a film and now read about in his book, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. Is there an unconventional teacher who perhaps changed your life? If you would like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Ann Strange-Hampson, and you're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now I'm feeling really weird because I'm living what Sun Tzu said. Those who go into battle and win and will want to go back, and those who lose in battle will want to go back and win. I've been winning battles, so I'm sort of going into battles, more battles. And I think it's sort of weird to be living what Sun Tzu said.
That's from a scene from World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements, the film about teacher John Hunter's World Peace Game. And he's also just written a book about the same thing, the World Peace Game. It's called World Peace, getting over the flu, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. And that's, I love that clip. I love that little boy.
Thank you. Yeah, he's great. Yeah, David was, he'd just come from a series of battles, and he discovered, using Sun Tzu's insights, that he was stuck in a cycle of violence. And his understanding wasn't that winning or losing is better or worse. It was that there's a cycle to this, and he had to get out of that cycle somehow. So his understanding was much deeper than I could have actually planned to teach him in designing that curriculum. He discovered it for himself, really.
Do your kids actually read Sun Tzu? I mean, what is this? Isn't it like 4th century, the art of war, martial philosophy?
I know. It's an amazing thing to see during recess a little girl go over to a big shade tree on the playground and sit down and pull out of her knapsack a pocket-sized copy of The Art of War and start reading to herself. You know, they do. They end up getting their own pocket-sized copies and walking about reading them during lunch or recess. And it's an amazing thought that the Sun Tzu has made it so that it's approachable and accessible by almost everyone. And of course, David's reinterpreting Sun Tzu. He's not even quoting him directly. He's having a new understanding, reinterpreting an ancient text. So bravo to David for looking that deeply into it.
Yeah, but so you're teaching fourth graders how to achieve world peace or think about world peace by first teaching them the art of generalship?
Well, you know, the art of war, really, it's a misnomer in a way. It's really how to avoid war, how to get out of it quickly with the least amount of damage and suffering to the people, is the way I phrase it. And the children see it as a guide to doing the best and not doing harm. So actually, they use it that way. And sometimes they ignore it completely. Sometimes they use it carefully. But it's just a helpful informational guide. And they brought it to me. Actually, it wasn't my idea at all. One of them said their moms read it. Their mother read it every night as a businesswoman. And the student thought it would be a great thing to have in the game. So we all decided to adopt it into a game. Their fault.
But going back to the lessons of failure, because that quotation that we heard, that clip from the little boy, you know, what he's basically saying is that he's gotten to a place where he feels stuck, like he's just caught in this endless loop, and he's kind of stuck and frustrated. And I think that's a large part of where you try to get your kids to the point where they feel like this isn't working. They're failing. You know, the world is in the point of exploding.
Yeah, that's right. The game, the way I designed it, it's designed to fail massively at first. And that despair that comes about is something that we guide them through into making successful attempts beyond that. You know, it's like life. There's failure in life. There's success. There's a range of things. And to pretend that failure doesn't exist or that it's bad, there's no moral stigma in the game to failing, to trying and not succeeding to achieve your goal the first go round. So with that luxury to fail, that stigma taken off, the students are more bold in experimenting and trying things, and they're supported in that. And it guards against hubris. You know, kids who think they're right all the time and they're going to get this right and they're going to solve it themselves. You know, failure shows them that it takes all of us to usually do that, and that we have to think and look more carefully into every problem.
But this is a lesson that goes beyond the fourth grade because, for instance, my kids are in high school. Our local high school just ran an evening session for parents on how to help your kids deal with perfectionism. Our high school is, you know, it's an upper middle class high school, and it's full of very perfectionistic, straight A kids who are terrified of failing.
Right. Well, those are worthy goals, and they come from worthy motives. But, you know, they're not really reflective of the actual existence we live in. And so what I think I'm trying to offer my students is a chance to experience the full range of existence in a safe, appropriate way, but to experience existence in all its aspects and facets, and to be able to learn to work with that, you know, to learn how to work through failure and not just duck every time you see it coming and pretend it's not there. So this range of skills that they develop, we call it, you know, some people say future-proofing, but the idea is that you're building skills that will be accessible to them for problems that we as teachers cannot even imagine. We're trying to teach 20, 30, 40 years ahead for things we can't even see. We're working in the unknown. So we have to incorporate the full range of tools at our disposal. And failure is one of those tools that they can learn from, that every obstacle can become a great opportunity if you look at it with that perspective.
I love that phrase, future proofing. Mm. Is that part of the underlying, you know, concept of what you're doing is trying to help children become the global citizens that this world is going to need?
Well, sure. As teachers, you're trying to help civilization really move forward. And how do we do that? Because we don't know individually what the future holds. We don't know what it looks like. We can't even imagine sometimes. So how do we teach? How do we solve for X? How do we solve for the future? And the way we've seen actually is by looking back in time and looking at universals in human nature. There's no technological tool that can solve every problem. But in how we use those tools and our own innate tools, we can approach a way of dealing with things we haven't even conceived of yet. So we're trying to teach very fundamental, critical, and creative thinking skills and tools, and even show the children how to create their own tools for situations that we've never thought about. So they're going into it with this kind of almost abstract toolkit that hopefully is so flexible and so dynamic and so original and creative that they can handle, as they say in the film, that we can solve anything if we come into it.
So what's another example? Is there another kid who comes to mind who really stayed with you?
Yeah, there's a beautiful child. Her name is Amy. Very shy, quiet little girl, big glasses. She had pigtails and braces. And she was the Minister of Defense of a very poor country. You know, the countries have different asset values in the game. And her Prime Minister Marcy said, "Amy, don't do anything with our Army and Navy. Just sit still because we don't have any money. We don't want to make anybody mad." So she's a Minister of Defense and she can't do anything. And Amy's right next door to a very large oil-rich neighbor, a country that's very powerful with a large military, great oil reserves. And suddenly, for no reason that we can discern, Amy, against her prime minister's orders, marches her tank column, her armor, and her air force and infantry into that country across the border and quickly surrounds its oil fields and reserves and locks it down without firing a shot. Amy, I know you'd never, never disturb a nine-year-old girl with tanks. You don't cross them. You know, they're dangerous. And so we're very upset, and my heart's breaking. I'm a teacher. I'm trying to teach a peace game here and peaceful resolution. And Amy's doing something totally contradictory to our ideals, and I don't understand it.
She's been sneaking off and reading Machiavelli's The Prince.
Yeah. She should be looking at Sun Tzu. She's looking at Machiavelli. But she crosses her arms, and she won't explain why she's doing this. And after the uproar, she maintains her position, and a few game days later, it comes to light what's going on. Amy's strategy is revealed. She understood long before any of the rest of us and before I ever saw it that this country, the large oil-rich neighbor, was secretly planning a quest for world domination. They were going to use their military to take over all the countries and lock the entire game and win that way. And that wasn't what I intended, but that was what was going to happen. It's their game. They can do it their way. She saw it coming. She saw the trend lines, the vectors, the personalities lining up, and she knew what was about to happen. So Amy made a philosophical decision and deep critical reasoning and understanding, and made her own decision to take it upon herself to create a small war, to start a small war to avert a larger one. Now think about the moral reasoning and the critical thinking that a 9-year-old girl had to do to come to that decision, and then to stand alone to do it in front of all her friends and against her teacher. What kind of courage that takes. So I'm so proud of kids who are given that room to think like that, and then will take the bull by the horns and actually do what they know is right and best for themselves.
Oh, that makes me want to know, what happens to kids who grow up? I mean, what's Amy doing now? I hope she's in Congress.
You know, there are some beautiful stories that come out of that. And I don't remember about Amy, but I know there's one, Irene Newman, who is at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And she's in War and Peace Studies now in International Diplomacy and Security Issues. And she wrote a letter saying, Mr. Hunter, I watched the TED Talk. I started crying at the end because I lived through that. You let me be a black market arms dealer. You let me defy the UN in the game 17 years ago. And because of that, now I'm in this study program. And my professors don't understand how I can solve these problems so readily. My fingers start to tingle, she says, when I deal with a diplomatic international incident. It's a wonderful feeling. And it comes from playing that game somehow. And you can imagine what kind of feeling a teacher gets in hearing from a student decades later who says that your effort, your intention made some effect, gave me some help in my life.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's a real assessment. That's the real assessment in teaching. It's not a snapshot test. It's a portfolio. It's a photo album. It's an entire life. The quality of their lives is what really shows you what education is about.
Wow. We've got a caller on the line. Bill from Madison wants to join us. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Did you have a question?
Well, I have a question and a I'll start with a comment. It seems like for the last several decades, especially in the last 20 years, a lot of so-called brain experts have been talking about how children's brains are not physiologically capable of this or that or the other thing. And it seems to me that that's an absolutely wrong-headed approach that we've been teaching for the last 40 years or so our kids to become more flat thinking. Look at people running the country now. Basically the baby boomers and starting into Generation X are some of the most flat thinking, rigid people.
Hey, and some of us aren't so bad.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about myself here. I'm a baby boomer, and the thing about a child's brain is that while they lack life experience and they lack information, they have incredible processing power because their brain, their thought processes have not been rigidly locked into certain patterns.
Mm-hmm. Hold on a sec. I think I know where you're going. So, John, what's interesting is the ways in which we shortchange and assume that because children don't have the body of knowledge that we've acquired in, 30 years of reading newspapers and books and going to school, that therefore their reasoning abilities and thinking abilities are less. In some ways, what Bill is saying, they may be greater than ours because they're not so bogged down in all that information.
Well, Bill makes a great point that, because of the lack of baggage, really, and the lack of experience, there's a freshness and openness. I didn't know it was wrong kind of way of thinking about problems that have plagued us for so long, for decades, as he's saying, for centuries, really. And so that kind of underutilized resource of the creative wisdom and the collective wisdom of children is just being revealed in things like the game. And I think there is good research, as Bill is saying, to support that, giving children the range to roam intellectually, creatively, is really the thing that helps the brain grow and stimulates their growth, rather than trying to train to one specific outcome on a given test on a given day.
Of course, I think, we also... Children seem so precious to us and so innocent, and we want so much to protect them. We want them to have those childhoods where they don't have to be so aware of the cost of life, the misery that waits for so many of us.
Well, it's interesting. We have that perception as adults about children, but they know. They're much more aware than we give them credit for. In our game, we have warfare, and it's possible you can engage in it or not. It's up to you, and you'll deal with the consequences. But, you know, they've got loved ones and friends and family members and all sorts of people who've been involved in that. And they're aware of what the costs of that are in some way in families across our country. And so just to illustrate, I remember being picked up at an airport by a young man, a teacher at one school that I was going to give a talk at. And I got in the car and I was presupposing this young man was well off. He had a nice car, lovely suit, nice haircut, shiny shoes, looked great, looked like he was a privileged young man. And so I kind of didn't really give him the consideration I should have. And he said in the car, "Mr. Hunter, I saw that film, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. I think it's a good thing you have in that film where the students write that letter. There's a letter in the game that if you wager troops in battle, little plastic soldiers on the board, and you lose them, you've got to write a condolence letter to the fictional parents of those fictional soldiers." Well, I said, "That's very good, sir. You like that? I appreciate that." And he said, "You know why I like that? Because I was a Marine Corps officer a year and a half ago, and I fought in the Battle of Fallujah, and I did several tours in Afghanistan and Iraq." And he said, "I had to myself write that letter. I had to make that phone call. I had to go to the parents' house. And I know what you're saying. And I think it's good that you have the children in a safe and bloodless way. Those children can at least have some idea of the consequences of the seriousness of this kind of thing. And they handle it fine." He said, "I think you should keep having them write that letter. Mm. It's important that they know that sort of thing."
Well, that's actually one of the most moving moments in the film, too.
Oh, yeah, it really is. And the children, you know, they say, well, you know, it's a play. It's a game to them. They understand some of the seriousness, but it doesn't hurt them. But we've had a parent. We ask a parent to read that letter once who is observing our class, and rather than having our prime minister read it. And she burst out into tears. She broke down. And I was in tears about it, too, because we understood as adults the really deep import of that. And I had no idea when I designed it in that it really had that far-reaching effect for adults. And for kids, it's just part of the game. It moves them through, and hopefully it leaves some memory of the consequences of their actions.
You want to start on your letter now? Miss Thompson, can I have that wand, please?
"Dear parents, I'm sad to inform you that while covering our capital, your sons and daughters were killed. I would have done anything for this not to happen, but I would like to say that they are true heroes, and they died in honor, for it takes a true hero to die for their country. From Prime Minister Thompson."
I'm Ann Strandchamps. We're talking with John Hunter today. He's an award-winning teacher, creator of the World Peace Game, which you can see in a film and now read about in his book, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. And if you'd like to join the conversation, perhaps you have thoughts about what today's kids need to become responsible global citizens, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. This is 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ann Strandchamps. Welcome to 45 North. We're talking with John Hunter, the creator of the World Peace Game. And John, we've got one of your former students on the line, actually.
Oh, my gosh.
Saoirse called us from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Oh, wonderful. Hi, Saoirse. How are you?
I'm good. I'm calling. I'm a freshman now, Mr. Hunter. And obviously it was the best class I'd ever had. The World Peace Game in Quest was just the most fun, and having it with you was amazing. But I was wondering if you could make an adaptation for high schoolers, or if there's a reason why you only do it for 10-year-olds.
Well, you know, that's a great question. Actually, it started in high school, and I played with high school before you came around, I'm afraid. But whenever I get the chance, I will play with high schoolers. And my general assignment, I'm an elementary school teacher, so that's where I bring out the game. But give me a chance with people your age, and we'll go to town. We've done that with teenagers and young adults even in Norway. And that's a very sophisticated game you and your peers could play, Saoirse, no doubt about it.
What about me? What about adults? What about people in their 50s? I feel like I could learn things.
You know, it's an amazing thing. The Defense Department invited my students there to talk peer-to-peer about how they created this space for reflection, this empty space in this World Peace Game. But the session I had with adults, I had it in Bergen, Norway, actually, a couple of summers ago. Wonderful session, lovely people, teenagers and young adults. There were Norwegians, Finns, Bosnians, a Czech, a Brit, and one American. And, you know, it was group process therapy. It was beyond my skills to really manage. A much more intense experience than children ever have. And so I would say that I need more training, I think, to be able to really work with adults because, you know, adults are playing with preconceived ideas and baggage, and they're playing against, you know, relationships they've had in the past, old romances or whatever. They're all beneath the surface there, but they're part of their play, and children don't bring so much in, so it's much more dynamic with kids in a more open way, I should say. Mm-hmm. But I love the chance to try.
Saoirse, how did playing the World Peace Game and having Mr. Hunter for a teacher impact your life, do you think?
Not only just a bunch of fun. I remember being in second grade, and you can only start playing when you're in third grade. And just you could see the board game every day when you went into Quest, and it was just so exciting, and everyone was just so excited and knew all about it. But it was definitely one of the things I really took away from it was having to collaborate, you know. The first year I played it, I was a prime minister of a country, and you have to work with people so much, and you have these really heated arguments, and you have to solve it, and you have this huge drive, and you just really want to win the game. So you have to make all these compromises and sacrifices that I never have any of those kind of conflicts in other classes. So it really teaches you that to work with other people with strong ideas, and also, you know, just you have to, it's just one of those things where you can't be afraid. You have to, like, go after what you need and try it and hope that it works. And that's just, it was just unlike any other class I've ever had.
What are you studying now? You said you're in college?
No, I'm a freshman in high school.
Oh, in high school. Okay.
Yeah. But it's definitely changed me and all of my friends who ever played it. It's just amazing. And he had a summer camp playing it, so I got to go back and play it after elementary school, but I would love to play it again.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Saoirse. Thanks so much. Saoirse is from a family. Actually, a number of her siblings have also played the game. I think her brother, Brennan, tried to build his own in the basement once, I heard, and get his neighborhood friends to play.
That's great. And we've also got Gene in Milwaukee has called in. Hi, Gene.
Hi there. A couple of things. My background is I'm a psychologist and educator, and you asked about some teachers that inspired. I had a high school teacher who was teaching trigonometry, and he was a teacher who only taught at our high school, our little high school, for 1 year. But he approached the class from a thinking standpoint, and as I told the screener, I went from doing math to thinking about math and thinking mathematically. And he would do wonderful things like giving you a problem. We never had homework in this course, but we were always problem solving. And he would give you an A for the day if you came up with a solution. And then if people worked together, which was, and I'm in my 60s, so you can guess back then, sharing notes and so on was very forbidden. But if you worked together to come up with a solution, then whoever worked together as a team got an A. And some of the people who were those perfectionists and who always wanted to do it just their own were very upset with him until they kind of shifted and got into that that format. So it was just... It really inspired me in my own teaching when I got to become an educator. And then one other thing, and I'm not sure who this quote comes from, but I know it comes from rat studies. But they said that the best education is for someone to roam freely in a rich and varied environment. That's one of the things that I've always tried to create for my own personal children and any of the children that I've worked with over the years.
Wonderful. You know, that idea, I love that, to be able to roam free in that rich environment. And to have that opportunity, to have that support and be facilitated in that by a teacher. That teacher, that math teacher, you had a wonderful, stunning way of teaching. I love that. And incidentally, I had a math teacher very much like that myself, Mr. Roussel, who really taught us math, but he really taught me more about life and how to live into life more fully and broadly, not just about solving a particular problem at one instance.
Talking with John Hunter, he's an award-winning teacher and creator of the World Peace Game, and we're talking about his new book, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. And I'm Ann Strangechamps, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hey, Michael Feldman here, asking you to join me this Saturday morning at Monona Terrace for a live broadcast of What Do You Know? My special guest this week will be the lovely Emmy-winning actress Julia Louis-Dreyfus. We'll be talking about the new season of her hit comedy series Veep and more. So come and be part of the fun. That's this Saturday, April 13th at Monona Terrace, right here in Madison. Doors open at 9:30 a.m. For more information and a chance to win tickets, click over to wpr.org/Madison.
And we're talking with John Hunter about the World Peace Game. John, tell us something about your roots as a teacher. You went to segregated schools in the South, right? And I think your mom was your own fourth grade teacher.
Yeah, there was no choice. Our district was very small, and it was a school with, I think, seven or eight classes, you know, one for each grade. And fourth grade, the only choice was my mother's classroom. And so, as I say in the film, it was a very quiet year. I was very careful, you know, tiptoeing through that environment.
It's low on the radar, huh? What was her teaching?
Yeah.
What was her teaching style?
Well, you know, it reflects in the game, actually. I didn't realize until years later, but she had a very quiet, quietest way of approaching things. Whenever I asked a question or ever put in a situation where something was required, she would wait and allow the situation itself to unfold first. And my father, very much the same. He was, they're both very quiet people, and they allowed a lot of space to be around a problem or conflict or an issue and to see what would come of it itself from out of itself first. And so that was kind of a habit in our family life, our culture around that time. We were in what I call the shadow school, working behind the scenes quietly in that segregated era. And that sort of played out in coming to the World Peace Game creation, and Sun Tzu was a perfect complement for that. He was a sort of master of light and shadow, I think, and the gray areas in between. And so my mother, when we were, brought out of segregation into integration, I was one of the first kids who was chosen from my school to go to an integrated school for the first time. And we were afraid. We didn't know what would happen. We had heard about things other people had been through, but we went on, and in my case, it became a beautiful experience. People opened and learned to open across the board. And so that was an opening effect, a transformative effect that I could see possible. And I wanted my curriculum to do that.
Mm-hmm. You found that you were more welcomed than opposed when you went to an integrated school?
There was a range of experiences, I'll say. I mean, certainly I experienced the full range, but somehow there were supporters, sometimes hidden, and there were people who were just honest, good people across the board on both sides who met and talked and worked out a way for us to survive, the handful of children who went. People from both communities who saw a greater understanding, a larger sense of a purpose and accomplishment possible. You know, we lost something in that tight-knit community that had its own strengths, of course, but then we gained access to the larger world. So in a way it was bittersweet, but certainly having the whole world open to you is a greater benefit in the long term, I think.
I want to go next to a caller on the line. We've got Joy from West Bend. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Thanks for this program, and I just really want to commend Mr. Hunter for creating this great vehicle for teaching about
thank
the
you,
gamut.
Joy.
I'm just wondering, do you go through any, do you introduce to the students any foundation of how peace strategies differ from war or aggression strategies? I have another question. I participated in teaching at a peace camp, and we had all kinds of curriculum that we could get on online, songs, crafts, so on and so forth. But I always try to just have a day when I ask the students, you know, as young as they were, like you, what are you doing? What are you already doing to help make peace in your family, in your community? And, you know, just point out to them that they're already doing this and they could think about what's going on in the world. So then my other question would be, have you ever had any resistance from parents, from the community, from school administrators to you introducing this kind of thinking?
Oh, great. Well, I'll address your first question. Oddly enough, there is absolutely no preparation whatsoever before the students come into this complex exercise. I find that coming in without that is actually better because they have a very open-minded approach and it's not preset in any way. The rich diplomatic and political vocabulary that they use in the film and in the game is all done, it's all taught in context. I'll say the word, repeat it, reframe it, and recontextualize it over and over and over again, and they pick it up and start using it themselves. But there's no geopolitical understanding, nothing at all. They're thrown into the deep end with the complexity well over their heads, and I really have the belief and now experience that they can handle it, and they do, and they show me that every time. As far as resistance, here's another odd thing. In 35 years of working with this exercise, I have never, ever had a negative complaint from a parent. This is very odd and very, I mean, I'm mystified myself. I have had a parent say to me one time, "Mr. Hunter, I hate that game." I said, "Oh my goodness, what have I done?" She said, "My daughter plays that game with three of her friends, and they all also play soccer. And I had to put them in my SUV and drive them to a soccer match 3 hours away. And at the top of their lungs for 3 hours, they discussed nuclear proliferation, international policy, refugee issues. Mr. Hunter drove me insane. And then they talked 3 hours on the way back. I hate that game." She said.
Oh, so, wow. Yeah,
kind of
what
fun.
A testament to your teaching into the game. That's really great.
Well,
but
yeah,
I want to pick up on something that you, a couple of little things you said. You referred to people who helped you in kind of a hidden way when you were in that mm-hmm. integrated school. And you've also talked about your family's kind of quietness as there being people who kind of worked on the shadow side. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you about that because I think that one thing people might conclude is that kids who've played the World Peace Game, or the point of playing the World Peace Game, is to raise a generation of activists, you know, people who will go out there and make a difference in the world. And I suspect that your feeling is that many more people are working toward making a difference in the world in many more ways than we often recognize.
That's right. That's right. And you know what I've found, and actually now going around the world with this game and the film, taking us out into different countries and across the U.S., that we have so many fantastic teachers teaching public and independent schools everywhere. But, you know, they haven't had the luxury of having a camera in their classroom to show us all what they're doing. You know, you may have one difficult situation and a film is made about it or a book is written about it. And that is the face of the story. And I'm finding just the opposite. I'm finding so much good teaching going on everywhere under dire circumstances sometimes. And so I'm just trying to, in the most humble way I can, share that there are so many great teachers teaching. And so the students who are working, some of them are out front, outspoken, and doing that work. Some of the teachers are. But there are many others who are, just by nature, you might call them reserved or quiet or working in the shadows, so to speak, who are doing great work. And in our classrooms, we don't try to necessarily change those children's nature if they're quiet or reserved. We want to facilitate them being the best person they can through their own natural way and adapt it into the curriculum. The ones who play the World Peace Game who are that way actually sometimes have the richest experiences. And you've got to check for understanding as a teacher. You're continually moving through the room, finding out what people are thinking, where they really are, even if they're not demonstrating it visibly every second, as we'd like, as some of us would like for children to do.
Do you think that playing this game has a lifelong effect on these kids and just in how they approach the world and how they handle problems as they grow up?
Well, you know, it's a bittersweet thing when a child is in your classroom and they leave. You know, they leave your school or you leave your classroom, your grade. You may never see them again. And you wonder, as a teacher, what happened to that child? You have them in your mind, and they stay with you. You know, they never really leave. And so when a student comes back years later, decades later, and lets you know how they're doing, and even says sometimes what the effect of what happened in your classroom had upon them, it's a magical thing, and it really makes things so much more rewarding and gratifying for a teacher.
John, I want to thank you so much for being here with us today. This has been inspiring.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
John Hunter is an award-winning teacher. He is the creator of the World Peace Game, which you can see in the film and also read about in his new book, which I highly recommend. It's full of wonderful stories. The book and the film are both called World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. I'm Ann Strangehamps, and you're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio.